It gives me enormous pleasure, though, to introduce to you today Alan Cromarty, who's the director of the Liberal Way of War programme at Reading University. It sounds very familiar, in a sense, that kind of title. And he's living evidence that there is actually life, intellectual life, going on at that other city in the other place. I sometimes wonder if there is a university there at all, but apparently there is. And here he is, a former scholar of Trinity, and did both his MA and his PhD, actually, at Cambridge. So he's living proof with us. So he's famous. You may have come across his work in terms of, what's very famous for his 17th century political thinking, particularly constitutionality. Politics. He's working at the moment on rights-based politics, I'm right saying, Alan, still. Hoping to get back to the 17th century. He's taken this diversion for 4 years into war. The most significant work C. Lane Corpus has written about Sir Matthew Hale, which came out in 1995, and he writes on Sir Thomas Hobbes and the Constitutional Revolution of the 17th century, which is actually where I began my own intellectual life at one point, so it shows you flowered where I didn't, I simply became stunted. His interests are in the ethics of war and philosophy of history alongside his issues about war. He's going to talk to us today about the very successful conference in July this year on the Liberal Way of War. Alan.
No, thanks so much, Rob. As Rob tactfully said, my qualification for talking to you about war is that I know rather little about war, at least in the sense that before I found myself director of a programme investigating the subject, I had no previous academic exposure to its study. At Rob's suggestion, this is a paper that's almost entirely the same as a lecture I gave at a conference earlier this year on the Liberal Way of War, strictly speaking on liberal wars, their character, their dynamics, the reasons why they get fought. It seemed to me, as I was directing the conference, that it was desirable that at some stage someone should turn up and say something about what had happened in the world before 1900, which wasn't otherwise represented in the conference, and to try to bring together a number of pieces of fairly basic information that we think we know about the way that war as a social and cultural institution has developed and the ways, of course, in which it might develop in future. I reckoned when I was standing up in Reading that what I had to say was probably well known, or about 60% of what I had to say was well known to virtually everyone in the room. But I hoped, obviously, that different people would know different 60%. It may well be that in this room I'm up to 90%, but I hope that the 10% of residual ignorance is distributed in an interesting kind of way. Anyway, this was originally called Liberalism and State Violence. A slightly more accurate title might be Three Models of State Violence, because I like to have something to read myself during the boring bits. I've distributed a handout. My basic thesis isn't complicated, or for that matter, new. What I'll be suggesting is that Western ideas about war have, until recently, described a social institution that's internal to one civilization, and that the intellectual tools with which we operate are therefore quite poorly adapted to a more complex world with a genuine plurality of values. I'll proceed by outlining three models of legitimate state coercion, and I offer these three models as a diagnostic tool. They represent three patterns of thinking about war that shouldn't be seen and haven't been seen as mutually exclusive. Most European thinkers have probably made some appeal to at least two of them. But it's possible to draw connections between the pattern that's dominant at any given time and wider socio-cultural conditions. Here and there, I think I do have some original perceptions, but I won't be straining unduly to be original. And the main purpose of the enterprise is to show ways of fitting quite commonplace ideas into an overarching synthesis that could, of course, be made the basis of discussion. In the last bit of the paper, I'll say something about the late John Rawls's Law of Peoples, a strange little book that has elements, I think, drawn from all three of my models of legitimate state coercion. It is, I think, an intellectual failure, but the reasons for its failure have an interest to people quite indifferent to the strange activity of university philosophy. They suggest some possible reasons why we keep on fighting wars and why we're serially disappointed with their outcomes. I'll start with three quotations from very famous works, which you'll find on my handout, of course, whose purpose is to crystallise in memorable form my models of legitimate coercion. The first is from Alberico Gentili's De Jure Belli Libri Tres of 1589. Demosthenes saith well, that war is meant against those who cannot be restrained in a judicial way. For judicial restraints are of force against those who are sensible of their inability to oppose them. But against those who are or think themselves of equal strength, wars are undertaken. This might be called the litigation model. The activity of warfare is understood, in other words, as a kind of litigation substitute against those who are or think themselves to be too powerful to be controlled by any other method. Second is taken from John Locke's second treatise, published a century later in 1689. The example's individual, not collective, but the theory that it illustrates is what I'll call the self-preservation model. For Locke, a state of war exists whenever any agent is menaced by life-threatening violence. In his excellent illustration, a man with a sword in his hand demands my purse in the highway, when perhaps I have not 12 pence in my pocket. This man I may lawfully kill. To another, I deliver £100 to hold only when I alight, which he refuses to restore me when I am got up again, but draws his sword to defend the possession of it by force. The mischief this man does me is 100, possibly 1,000 times more than the other perhaps intended me, whom I killed before he really did me any, and yet I might lawfully kill the one, and cannot so much as hurt the other. The reason whereof is plain, because the one using force which threatened my life, I could not have time to appeal to the law to secure it. And when it was gone, 'twas too late to appeal. The law could not restore life to my dead carcass. Here too, legitimate violence begins when social situations escape control by ordinary judges. But the underlying theory is somewhat different. In the litigation model, war begins when litigants are left without a sanction. In the self-preservation model, it begins when somebody is threatened by irreparable damage, typically, though not as it happens always, by taking away life. Law is useless in a conflict situation where the damage that is threatened is irreversible. The law could not restore life to my dead carcass. Although this situation has often been described as self-defence, and I'll be quoting a couple of people who do so, the term self-defence is unhelpfully broad in this context. The defining feature of the situation is not the fact you've been attacked, but the fact that you face a specially significant type of damage. An interesting implication follows. In the litigation model, your opponent is no more than an opponent who may for quite long periods be harmless. You may, what is more, be quarrelling over something trivial that should be fought for in a measured fashion. It's not sensible to nuke Buenos Aires to recover the Falkland Islands. But in war conceived of as self-preservation, what matters is not the subject of the quarrel, but the maximum extent of your vulnerability. The litigation model can be interpreted to incorporate a rule about proportionality. The self-preservation model creates a privilege of extreme and disproportionate reaction. A third quotation is probably the most famous single statement ever produced by any liberal. It's John Stuart Mill's harm principle. The only purpose for which power can rightfully be exercised over any member of a civilised community against his will is to prevent harm to others. This principle limits legitimate coercion. It's not always noticed, however, that the privilege of freedom from paternalist coercion does not attach to individuals qua individuals, or even to civilised individuals qua civilised individuals, but only to individuals who may or may not be civilised themselves, who belong to civilised communities. As Mill explained on the next page, we may leave out of consideration those backward states of society in which the race itself may be considered as in its nonage. The early difficulties in the way of spontaneous progress are so great that there is seldom any choice of means for overcoming them, and a ruler full of the spirit of improvement is warranted in the use of any expedients that will attain an end perhaps otherwise unattainable. Here Mill implies the existence of a third type of legitimate coercion, which I will call the civilising or progressive model. Now, any culture might, of course, attack another because of some cultural practice it found objectionable. But I take it that a liberal kind of civilising war must be informed by a progressive theory, some reason for supposing that the illiberal act of stopping other people doing something will, in the end, in some sense, make them freer. This is certainly the case in Mill's own thinking. At the heart of his thought was a very sharp distinction between societies where progress happened, in which variety was to be cherished, and societies where it didn't, in which it was not. There was bound to be trouble when people lost their former confidence in the validity of this distinction. So those are the three models. I don't suggest the list is necessarily exhaustive. There's also, for example, a punishment model invented by Hugo Grotius and taken over in some moods by John Locke. But I do believe they represent the most important options that are compatible with liberalism broadly conceived. They appear to be quite simple, but all three, on closer inspection, have some unexpected features that place a limit on their usefulness. I'll start by saying more about the litigation model, which, because of its historical significance, is actually the one that I'll be talking about for most of the rest of the next 40 minutes. The achievement of the litigation model was to supply war with a guiding purpose, the settlement of disputes between supreme political powers, by reference to which the activities of soldiers could be both organised and regulated. It managed to make war susceptible of a degree of order, while separating it from moralism. Among other things, it did so by supplying a rationale for a competent-non-competent distinction. War settled disagreements between sovereigns through a contest between specialised employees. The idea of such a contest both justified the activity and helped to limit it. In time, it stimulated the rather fruitful notion that soldiers could do all but only the violent things that put their adversaries out of action. But the model required a distinction, the very sharp distinction, between the soldier's ultimate employer, i.e. a sovereign state, and the society the sovereign governed. It presupposed, in other words, that every polity would be inhabited by a single agent that was the ultimate court of appeal and ultimate locus of authority, that could legitimately coerce, but could not be coerced. It was realised that this boiled down to an unfettered power of making positive law. In other words, it presupposed Jean Baudin's proclamation in 1576, in other words, just 12 years before Gentili, that a commonweal, a république, is a lawful government of families and of that which unto them in common belongeth, with a puissant sovereignty. In a helpful clarification, Gentili himself remarked that reason shows that war was brought in out of necessity, because there cannot be courtroom dealings between sovereign princes and free peoples if they do not agree, and these are sovereign and merit the name of public persons. On this view, war is rational and licit because it's a requirement of a world that's inhabited by sovereigns. The model thus treats war as a condition that subsists between two sovereigns whose purpose is to settle disagreements, because the very nature of supreme political power precludes those disagreements being settled in other ways. I should say at this point that this model of sovereignty doesn't necessarily suppose, as Baudin and Hobbes supposed, that sovereignty is necessarily individual. The agent that cannot be coerced can, at least in principle, be a complex agent. But at all events, it's because you have a world with sovereigns in it that war is a legitimate and morally defensible kind of enterprise. The rationality of the institution has the effect of bracketing off behaviour within war from those considerations that make it right or wrong to undertake military action in the first place. And the upshot is that soldiers who fight within the rules will not face punishment for the crime of losing. It's reasonable to levy reparations, in just the same way that litigants will often ask for costs, but wrong once the issue is settled to display vindictiveness. There comes a point at which the matter is closed, as in all litigation-type activities. The whole point about war is it gives you a final decision. Gentili's conception of warfare is the natural counterpart of Jean Baudin's conception of a puissant sovereignty. It's guaranteed and guided by the same moral framework that guarantees the powers of the sovereign. On the litigation model, it's not coincidental, nor is it simply a product of power politics, that legislation and belligerence, the making of wars and of laws, are the responsibility of the same public person. It's a logical necessity. It's therefore been disastrous for the serious study of war that this Baudinian sovereignty has been misunderstood. It's been maintained, for instance, that sovereignty was meant as a response to scepticism about moral knowledge in the context of the novel pluralism that was created by the Reformation. In the extreme view of Carl Schmitt, the sovereign of Baudin and later of Hobbes was the ultimate source of value, enjoying privileges so extensive that they were unintelligible except as a lightly secularised version of the power that's enjoyed by God himself. This is completely false, I'm happy to say. If you're mesmerised by the undoubted power of Schmittian thought, then cheer yourself up with the reflection that it's historically absolute nonsense. It would be truer to say that Bodin was happy for sovereigns to have unfettered power of legislation because the activity of legislation was relatively rather unimportant. Point is probably best explained by offering a bit more exposition of Bodin's programmatic definition. A commonweal, a republique, is a lawful government of families, this of course is on my handout, and of that which unto them in common belongeth, with a puissant sovereignty. There are 3 points here worth unpacking. The first is that Bodin is concerned with lawful government. He acknowledges the existence of a criterion, natural law, by which a government can be unlawful. To cite an example he knew of, the government of the Aztecs would not have been a lawful government. The second is that there exist some lawful governments that do not qualify as commonweals. A republique, or commonweal, was a particular political form that was, in his time, confined to Western Europe. The Sultan of the Ottomans was an effective and a lawful ruler, but his dominions weren't a commonweal. This was because his monarchy was patrimonial. It didn't acknowledge the property of subjects. Like many people subsequently in the Western tradition, he regarded respect for private property as the ultimate acid test of a civilized state. The third, which is related to the second, is that 3/4 of his definition is actually drawn from Aristotle. You'll remember that a commonweal is a lawful government of families and of that which unto them in common belongeth. Down to belongeth, there's nothing new. But I had taken over from Aristotelian thought the basic Aristotelian distinction between a public and a private sphere, and his sovereign must respect this basic framework. Other things being equal, in the Bodinian world, there is a private space in which people have possessions and bring up children, as well as a more public space that's immediately controlled by the community. The sovereign cannot change this basic structure. He cannot change what Bodin called the fundamental laws, such as the law controlling the succession, and except in an emergency, he cannot levy tax without consent. Under no circumstances at all can he break his promises. In other words, he's not a lawful god. He enjoys a degree of discretionary power to override the private rights of subjects, but cannot actually abolish them. In particular, he must respect his subjects' property. Although he cannot be coerced, he operates within a firm normative framework that's enforced by fear of God and of rebellion. Now, the point here, for our purposes, is that Bodin is proto-liberal in that Bodinian sovereignty exists within an overarching framework. Given a degree of consensus about the models to be emulated, a point that I'll soon be coming back to, there were, moreover, well-established methods of giving that framework some applicable content. A sovereign who aspired to rule a commonweal would spend his leisure moments studying law and history. This would allow him to draw detailed guidance from the historic practice of comparable states and, of course, from the best men of the best times. Mutatis mutandis, the same can be said of Gentili. Gentili had written a book, De Jure Belli, about the law of war, and the whole point of his project was to set out a framework for the external practice of the sovereign. He wanted to distinguish regulation of the actual conduct of belligerents, jus in bello, from the considerations that might or might not justify the decision to start fighting in the first place. If he was to succeed in this objective, he needed some historical materials to which he could appeal to give his laws of war some content. He found them in the Law of Nations, or Jus Gentium. Jus Gentium was known by the consensus gentium, that is, by the common consent of human beings. It's important to this train of thought, and to the later history that I'm shortly to explain, that the Latin word consensus, like the English word consent, incorporates a rather fruitful ambiguity. It could be, as it were, passively construed. It could refer, in other words, to deliverances of reason as registered in human behaviour patterns. Stuff is thought to be rational because it's what actually happens. Or it could be actively construed as a kind of tacit treaty, deliberately created by some kind of act of will. In either case, there was an obvious problem. Different cultures, notoriously evolve quite different moral ideas. This is, of course, the age of Montaigne, amongst other things. Even those inclined to minimise moral diversity had read of the existence of remote and deviant peoples, Thracians, Brazilians, Germans, so on and so forth, that tolerated radical departures from what might be supposed to be self-evident principles. The only possible answer was to privilege some peoples over others, to appeal to the examples of the most civilised. As Thomas Hobbes ironically put it, "For the most part, such writers as have occasion to affirm that anything is against the law of nature do allege no more than this, that it is against the consent of all nations, or the wisest and most civil nations. But it is not agreed upon who shall judge which nations are the wisest." The logic of Euscentium thus tended to push people from an appeal to putatively natural principles to an appeal to actual state practice. It was a commonplace that 17th century writing about international norms made relatively routine appeal to philosophical considerations. In other words, that natural law either had or was at least presented as having a quite important bearing on state practice, while late 18th century and 19th century writing was dominated by collections of treatises in which the residual natural component was the principle, pacta sunt servanda, that treatises should be kept. The principles states respected were coming to be understood as the collective product of a society of states, working explicitly through treaty making and tacitly through international custom. In the course of the period, in other words, from 1700 towards 1900, there was a shift from the passive to the active understanding of consent. But though the shift may seem to be dramatic, it didn't involve a decisive break with the previous assumptions. It did, however, involve an intensified focus on implicit and tacit expressions of the will of a short list of states. The various collections of treaties that were put together in the 18th and 19th centuries described the actions of Westphalian sovereigns who formed and who were felt to form a society with shared norms. War was an institution through which they managed and settled disagreements. There were three obvious reasons why war was limited and why its shape was relatively stable. One was that technological change was relatively slow, that it was possible in principle for everyone to fight in the same way. Anyone could hire a regiment of Hessians. A second, as Rousseau pointed out, was that military power was sufficiently fragmented that a grab for universal power would not be feasible. Rousseau additionally, rather interestingly, remarked that this happy situation would come to an end if ever Germany were unified. Both parties to most wars expected their opponents to survive them and fight again on subsequent occasions. What went around would come around, especially among professional soldiers. You had a repeated game, you might say, and in repeated games it makes rationals behave in a rather more moderate fashion than it is in one-shot games. Third was that everyone subscribed to roughly the same value system, including broad consensus about the proper limits of state action. Though Anglo-Saxon writers were prone to fits of self-congratulation about their superior safeguards for private liberties, all European countries had rule-bound governments. Whether they interfere with property or personal liberty, they generally presented themselves as exercising an emergency power to override popular privileges whose broad legitimacy they accepted. In other words, when they do relatively despotic things, they accept in principle these are things that you shouldn't ordinarily do. As David Hume incurred some unpopularity by remarking, "It may now be affirmed of civilized monarchies what was formerly said in praise of republics alone, that they are governments of laws, not of men. They are found susceptible of order, method, and constancy to a surprising degree. Property is there secure, industry encouraged, the arts flourish, and the prince lives secure among his subjects, like a father among his children." The last phrase is obviously a tease, but nonetheless the general point is well taken. Under these circumstances, there was little moral cost in having a firm norm prohibiting intervention. It was unlikely that a major civilized state would do anything that was particularly bad. The conventional view of 18th century warfare may underestimate its savagery. I've noticed that most of the often quoted remarks on the subject come from Scots living well away from war zones, but nonetheless, there are reasons why you'd expect a degree of moderation. There's a strategic logic to behaving well. Well, moreover, there's scope for incremental reciprocal restraint, at least within the circle of civilised sovereigns, including a startling degree of respect for private property. To list these preconditions is also, of course, to explain why war beyond the circle was rather different. War against non-Europeans was increasingly technologically unequal. Outright conquest was quite often feasible. There was little expectation of reciprocity, and there was no negative feedback against misdemeanors. It also explains why war at sea tended to be different. War at sea was dominated by a single superpower who didn't face adversaries of a completely equal kind. Might have been expected then that the litigation model would not outlast the 19th century. It rested on shared values that made it possible to fight about particular disagreements without envisaging those disagreements as part of a struggle between good and evil. To use a more Clausewitzian terminology, it presupposed relatively low energy wars in which the combatants fell short of total mobilisation. But the 19th century attempts to codify restraint suggested that the model was in basically good shape. We're talking here, of course, about the 1880s and 1890s. There was a broad consensus that war could be regulated, but the proper aim of regulation was to insist that violence be focused upon destroying military forces. A civilised power was permitted to do all but only the things essential to the activity of fighting. There were, however, forces that had a tendency to undermine the litigation model. As everyone knows, in this room anyway, an obvious example was the problem that was posed by irregular fighters. An advantage of the litigation model was that it made it relatively easy to defend a competent, non-competent distinction. But by the later 19th century, the prospect of the appearance of irregular fighters was a political reality, and the Belgians made the error of boasting of their willingness to rely upon such fighters with ultimately tragic consequences. In the absence of agreement on the subject, large states basically were against irregular fighters, small states which could be overrun rather quickly were somewhat in favour, the Society of Nations was driven to fall back on a humanitarian principle, the celebrated Martens Clause of 1899, whose business end, of course, appeals to the usages established by civilised nations, the laws of humanity, and the requirements of the public conscience. In the face, in other words, of really serious disagreement, there was a tendency to retreat to older understandings of the jus gentium, understandings that treated international norms, as it were, passively, as intimations of some kind of shared reality, as opposed to the deliberate creations of the shared will of a community. The intellectual regress, if that's what it was, could, of course, be taken further. States that persistently refused to acknowledge or had a persistently different impression of the laws of humanity and the requirements of the public conscience could acquire an inferior moral status that jeopardised equality between belligerents. The process can be seen in operation in the 1949 Geneva Convention, which declares that even explicit persistent objections to a new war of law shall in no way impair the obligations which the parties to the conflict shall remain bound to fulfil by virtue of the principles of international law as they result from the usages established by civilised nations, from the laws of humanity and the requirements of the public conscience. Someone whose vision of the world was focused on the excesses of conservative nationalism would thus be driven towards moralism. But someone who was more impressed by liberal nationalism and the potentially emancipating capacity of nationalism could be driven in an opposite direction that also tended to undermine the litigation model. If state violence is conflict resolution, if violence is dangerous, it's expensive, and if states agree on fundamental values, it should be possible to devise a collective security system that enforces a resort to arbitration. As the 20th century discovered, this is easier said than done. But the train of thought involved is far from obviously mad, especially if one takes a fairly optimistic view of the civilising effects of global commerce. Western civilization for two centuries has had mood swings about the extent to which global commerce can be expected to civilize, but in what you might call the upswing, when you're optimistic about what might result, it's perfectly sensible to hope that you might one day be able to devise some sort of binding arbitration system. These thoughts that naturally emerge from the litigation model take us onto the territory explored to great effect by Michael Hyatt, especially in his War and the Liberal Conscience, which I'll discuss a bit further in a moment. Any liberal society, especially one inclined to the more rationalistic forms of purely economic liberalism, will be tempted by a simple train of thought. War is dangerous and expensive, and no community as a whole could possibly desire it. It follows that it must result from sinister interests that somehow distort the decision-making process, whether these are native interest groups or alien imperialist sovereigns. But all would be well if the world could dispose of oligarchy or imperialism, perhaps in a once-for-all process of a war to end all wars that would allow its peaceable and democratic nations to shatter a dysfunctional state system. The litigation model thus starts a train of thought that tends to encourage its own abolition. But those who have abandoned it have found themselves forced back on my second, or self-preservation model. The 1928 Kellogg-Briand Pact, the one, of course, that outlawed the use of war as an instrument of national policy, was based on an unspoken understanding that non-aggressive war would be permitted. The opponents, Frank Kellogg, held the quite extreme position that self-defence is inherent in every sovereign state and implicit in every treaty. Every nation is entitled at all times and regardless of treaty provisions to defend its territory from attack or invasion, and it alone is competent to decide whether circumstances justify a recourse to war in self-defence. Now, there are obvious problems here. If this is taken seriously, then Wilhelmine Germany was presumably entitled to defend itself from Belgium, and so on and so forth. Presumably, moreover, it's long been known that legitimate self-preservation shades imperceptibly into preemption. If, for example, somebody with hostile purposes is about to build a very powerful weapon. As Montesquieu long ago put it, with states the right of defence carries along with it sometimes the necessity of attacking. To make things worse, the plea of self-defence has a tendency to lead to escalation. At the very least, it's plausible to argue that the existence of a state of war has the effect of licensing a level of response sufficient to bring the war to its conclusion. So what you might have thought of as the great selling point of the self-defence arguments, which is that they provide a very clear criterion for legitimate war, tends to dissolve in the face of historical experience. Now, a full discussion of this point would take another paper. You'll note, though, that I've assumed, without an argument, that Kellogg and Montesquieu's right of defence is grounded in what I've called self-preservation. There is, of course, a rule within the litigation model that if an actor is attacked, it can defend itself. A rule of this sort could, in principle, be abolished. But I assume the argument that grounds the inherent right, irrespective of our positive law arrangements, has something to do with the notion that an unrepelled attack can cause us an irreparable and or an infinite harm. In practice, the harm usually alleged is not to people or property, but values. A particularly striking example of that line of argument I printed on the handout in the mouth of Ronald Reagan. There's one particular context in which this kind of claim, a claim that war is fought for self-preservation being understood as the preservation of an infinitely precious value, has been in practice unavoidable. All the leading liberal states have either built nuclear weapons or chosen to shelter beneath the American nuclear umbrella. Now, the point of nuclear weapons lies in the disproportion of the havoc that they threaten. It's difficult to defend them unless they're a shield against an effectively infinite evil. The most plausible defence of their possession appears to be some version of Michael Waltz's argument from Supreme Emergency, which emphasises the importance of the value that is threatened in an extreme emergency situation. The evil that's threatened and that might in principle justify the use of a nuclear bomb is the extinction of a value that's embodied in the state in question. Third and final picture of illicit violence is what I've called the civilising model. That is, in effect, the flip side of Mill's harm principle. On the Millian view, you'll remember, it's wrong to coerce human beings if their autonomy, or strictly speaking, their freedom, might lead to progress. But the freedom that leads to progress is only found in civilised surroundings. In less happy places, the primacy of progress can and indeed should lead to any level of coercion that might kickstart the civilising process, which was doubtless, Mill himself understood his day job as a diligent employee of the East India Company. Mill thought the law of nations did not apply to the uncivilized. In his fascinating essay, A Few Words on Intervention, he argued first that the rules of ordinary international morality imply reciprocity, but barbarians will not reciprocate. And secondly, that nations which are still barbarous have not yet gone beyond the period during which it is likely to be for their benefit that they should be conquered and held in subjection by foreigners. Barbarians have no rights as a nation, except a right to such treatment as may, at the earliest possible period, fit them for becoming one. I've been, of course, unfair to Mill in singling out one strand within his thinking. But his evident combination of extreme individualism at home with extreme authoritarianism elsewhere does alert us to a paradox inherent in most types of liberalism. If what is valued is some kind of freedom, and if the free individual is the unusual product of a certain kind of culture, then there's some kind of duty to bring people to the point at which that kind of culture comes into being, and the individuals in question are in consequence in a position to act freely. Stronger the commitment to the value of freedom, the greater the temptation to make use of violence. And this brings me, you'll be glad to hear, at last to the present and the liberal way of war that our own generation has developed. If I'd been giving this paper in 1975, I'd surely have had two preoccupations. One would have been the possibility of large-scale war in Europe that would presumably have turned into a nuclear war. The other would have been the threat or promise of nationalist liberation movements. If ideology had been a topic, discussion would surely have focused on the cleavage between Marxists and non-Marxists. Michael Hard's War on the Liberal Conscience, delivered as lectures in Cambridge in 1977, gives the term liberal itself a comically baggy definition, whose only purpose, as he freely admitted, was to exclude the Marxists. Basically, you're a liberal if you hope to make the world a better place. Hard's own theory of war was the one that I've attributed to Gentili. He saw it as an inherent element in a society of sovereign states which lacks any supreme and sovereign arbiter. And the most important target of his lectures was the development from this tradition that I discussed a little earlier, the notion that you might replace this dysfunctional state system with a peaceable society of nations. Hard thus had reason to assume that nothing much had changed. Both he and the idealists he made fun of were focused at the state or nation level. They assumed, and he denied, that nations would cease to fight if only they were controlled by better people. But in fact, there already existed a quite different diagnosis, which was attractive to the kind of people who were formerly attracted to liberal nationalism and had already started to convert them. The United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights stated that recognition of, I quote, the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of justice, freedom, and peace in the world, and that disregard and contempt for those rights have resulted in barbarous acts which have outraged the conscience of mankind. The direction of the causal chain is rather interesting. It doesn't say that barbarous acts involve contempt for rights, but rather that contempt for rights has resulted in barbarous acts. Its vision, you might say, is granular or atomic. If we sort out individual rights, then everything else will follow. Unlike the conventions that follow, the Declaration isn't, of course, a treaty document. It's a declaration that set out to be a standard of achievement, which is why states permitted its existence. But it licensed the impression, which has strengthened ever since, that there exists a global moral consensus that's an absolute constraint on state activities. To put the point another way, it's encouraged the view that the ultimate moral reality is the privileges of individuals. In the last analysis, both states and nations draw what legitimacy they have from their propensity to support a human rights-based order. This has important consequences for how we think about war. You'll remember that the main presupposition of the entire Gentilian tradition was that war was rational because states were rational. This vision of war collapses if states aren't actually rational at all, or if their rationality is contingent on respect for some deeper moral reality. A work on the liberal conscience today would be unable to sustain the old state-centred focus. In any prolonged discussion of the topic, someone would sooner or later appeal to human rights. ultimate criterion to which polities must conform has come to be a real or imagined consensus about the proper treatment, in other words, of individuals. States qua states do not have rights, they have responsibilities. And the nature of those responsibilities means that states are instrumental. A state, for example, that loses control over its territory is no longer typically seen as being merely ineffective. In an interesting expression, it is a failed state. Its instrumental ineffectiveness means that it can be doubted if it's a state at all. Now, this is an extremely momentous imaginative shift that we'll be working through for generations. We're wrong to speculate about its full effects during the last 10 minutes of a paper. We can, however, see some of the strain it creates by turning at last, as I promised at the start, to John Rawls's Law of Peoples. I've chosen Rawls not only because he's unquestionably the greatest liberal theorist of the second half of the 20th century, but because his chosen method makes his ideas particularly revealing. Rawls was committed to the view that the moral theorist's task was in a curious way historical. It's far from clear that there is moral truth, but one thing, I quote, is certain. People profess and appear to be influenced by moral conceptions. These conceptions themselves can be made a focus of study, which is in fact what Rawls did. Curious thing about Rawls's reputation that he's most often attacked for being thoroughly anti-historical, and it is indeed, I think, the case that he has a rather sentimental view of what has actually been happening in the last few centuries. But it's not the case that he is a pure theorist whose conception of his subject involves no element of sociological or historical study. In order to do this, Rawls continues in the passage I've been quoting, one tries to find a scheme of principles that match people's considered judgments and general convictions in reflective equilibrium. Given this general project, it would of course be mad to try to develop an ethic for the whole human race. And Rawls's best and earliest work, culminating in his theory of justice in 1971, was confined to working out a theory that captured the principles inherent in American conceptions, or at least, which wasn't entirely the same thing, the conceptions of the well-informed and highly educated. He thus worked out a theory for a liberal political order that balanced meritocracy with a commitment to redistribution. He had produced a theory about what Americans thought that had no special bearing on attitudes elsewhere. Now, the subsequent political history of America strongly suggests that he misread the attitudes of his fellow Americans. But the point is that the project was in essence conservative. His purpose was to tidy up existing attitudes. His last book, Law of Peoples, of 1999, is also quite conservative in many of its conclusions. That is its interest for our purposes. It's an attempt to adapt some quite familiar ideas to a world that's informed by rights-based thinking. John Rawls had long been criticised from the political left for his apparent focus on justice within states at the expense of justice between nations. In the second half of his career, he had numerous admirers who wanted to extend his work to create a juster world by advocating transfers of resources between nations. But the Law of Peoples is essentially loyal to the inherited verities of liberal nationalism. He treated patriotism as an intrinsic good and defends, for example, controls on immigration. He acknowledges a duty of assistance to societies that he describes as burdened by circumstances outside their control, but minimises the extent to which this will involve financial transfers. The reason, he insists, why some cultures are rich and others poor has little to do with levels of resources and almost everything to do with culture. He accepted the Waltzerian view that there are no limits to military action in conditions of supreme emergency, and even excluded pacifists from high political office. So this is in fact a book that you might expect someone to write if, like Rawls, they had fought with some distinction in the Pacific. Like so many figures in Michael Howard's pages, he chose, however, to believe that war could be abolished if states acquired the right internal structures. As a good Kantian, he believed two things. The first was that countries governed by their peoples will seldom or never make war on one another. The second is that liberal and democratic cultures can indefinitely reproduce their values, and that well-ordered nations that are not yet liberal, the category he called the decent nation, the decent peoples, will tend over time to move in a more liberal direction. The Rawlsian Law of Peoples acknowledges five categories of people. The first is liberal peoples. The second is what he calls the decent peoples, who are entitled to the same respect, very important point, but who diverge in minor ways from liberal principles. They need not, for example, hold elections, they might have an established church, and so on and so forth. But the condition of the respect they enjoy from liberal peoples is the respect they give to human rights, which are basically the rights proclaimed, and specific about this, from Article 3 to Article 18 of the Universal Declaration. This leaves three kinds of people that have yet to be well ordered. The first, she barely mentions, is enlightened absolutism, which respects for human rights but doesn't consult with its subjects. The second is the burdened peoples I've already mentioned, to which we owe a fairly limited duty of assistance, but to raise them to a fairly minimal threshold. The last is what he called the outlaw regimes. He tries to use the word regimes, obviously, to avoid attributing their problem to the people, which are oppressive and expansionist. And here we encounter a fascinating tension that strongly suggests he was driven towards a conclusion that he found difficulty in accepting. Rawls is clear that the immediate task of foreign policy is to contain the outlaw states in the name of what I've called self-preservation. But its long-term guiding purpose is more Millian. It's to bring all societies eventually to honour the law of peoples and to become full members in good standing of the society of well-ordered states. He excuses himself from saying much more on the grounds that the implementation of this general policy is not a matter for philosophers, reasonable enough point. He also implies on a number of occasions that the rationale for fighting against an outlaw state is its inherent tendency towards expansionism. Well-ordered peoples, he says, do not wage war against each other, but only against non-well-ordered states whose expansionist aims threaten the security and free institutions of well-ordered regimes and bring about the war. You'll note, incidentally, that it's the expansionist aims that are crucial. This is Lockean self-preservation thinking, in that it is the threat that's morally crucial. It doesn't have to be carried into action. Moreover, the situation is asymmetrical. Unlike a state respecting human rights, an outlaw state has no right to fight back. Under the law of peoples, an outlaw state does not possess a right of self-defence. This isn't perhaps particularly surprising. It should, however, be noted that it isn't very difficult to get into the outlaw category. Rawls mentions early modern Spain and France entirely, it seems, on the grounds that they fought dynastic wars that didn't promote the interests of their peoples. Rawls leaves, in fact, plenty of scope for Lockean or self-preservation warfare. In our present situation, though, the greatest interest attaches to the Millian or civilising version. The similarities with Mill are fairly obvious. Like Mill, he denies that outlaw states have rights. Like Mill, he thinks that other states have got a general duty to set more primitive peoples upon the path of progress whenever reasonably possible. In a couple of respects, though, his motives for intervention were actually more powerful than Mill's. Mill believed that progress, once started, could come to a halt, even in civilised societies. Rawls, by contrast, is extremely optimistic that progress, once established, can be expected to be self-sustaining. Secondly, Mill did not believe in universal rights. He wanted, of course, to minimise pain, but had no interest in rights per se, except insofar as they tended to bring about progress. He wouldn't have felt any reason to act if, for example, Muslims had started persecuting animists. A Rawlsian people, by contrast, has some duty to step in whenever it can reasonably do so. There are, of course, good reasons to be cautious. Wars typically cause more and much more serious rights violations than they're ever likely to prevent. But if other things are equal, a Rawlsian has few reasons for not fighting. Rawls recognised this logic. We can be sure he did so because he took great pains to hide it in a footnote. If you look at my copy on page 93, you'll see that the text, which could have been written in the 1930s, reposes faith in international pressure, international public opinion, and the effects of economic sanctions. In the footnote, though, he eventually bites the bullet. It's interesting to note that, normally speaking, what you put in footnotes are brilliant ideas that you've recently had and can't quite fit into the main structure of the argument. The argument of this particular footnote follows directly from what's been said in the paragraph before. So there's some sort of motive going on here that is leading him to put it in slightly smaller print. And this, as I've put on the handout, is what he says. If it is ever legitimate to interfere with outlaw states simply because they violate human rights, even though they are not dangerous and aggressive towards other states, and indeed may be quite weak, that's a question, of course. Certainly, there is a prima facie case for intervention in such cases. Yet one must proceed differently with advanced civilizations than with primitive societies. Primitive isolated societies, with no contact with liberal or decent societies, we really have no way to influence. It's not entirely clear to me if that's an argument in favour of or against intervention in such cases. But those that are more developed, he goes on, seeking trade or other cooperative arrangements are a different story. Nonetheless, Feynman admits, ostracism may fail. If so, if the offences against human rights are egregious and the society does not respond to the imposition of sanctions, such intervention in the defence of human rights would be acceptable and would be called for. In other words, he can't quite bring himself to say the word. There are circumstances under which aggressive war is actually a duty. Now, I've concentrated on expounding rules, partly for want of time in which to speak of other thinkers, but mostly because his short essay is extraordinarily revealing. Rawls is a well-intentioned man of great philosophical powers, whose story is the duty of a philosopher to set out in mildly idealised form the instincts of his culture. He wanted to state principles that would, on reflection, be seen as being theoretically attractive, given the way we are, and as offering a feasible basis for action. We've seen that the theory he produced had elements that are taken from all three of my ideal types. Like thinkers who draw on the litigation model, he firmly held that states are good, at least if they are organised as nations. What he added to this model, like many liberals who have gone before him, is that litigation warfare is quite unnecessary. It's possible to imagine a society of states whose culture and internal constitution meant that they had no differences that couldn't be resolved by arbitration. This culture would, moreover, be self-sustaining. Those who had lived in such a state would find ways of transmitting its values to their children. From the self-preservation model, he took the idea that threat of an irreparable harm, less to its people than its institutions, can justify a country in resorting to armed conflict. He also explicitly stated there were circumstances, extreme emergencies, in which it was appropriate to break the normal rules, thus tacitly accepting nuclear weapons. Lastly, he has affinities with the civilising model. But though I've used John Stuart Mill to illustrate this model, it can be clearly seen, I hope, that the animating impulse is rather different. Mill was utilitarian. He wanted to minimise pain. But his utilitarianism allowed him quite a large scope for manoeuvre. The Rawlsian position is rather different. He agrees with Mill that barbarous states have no rights, but lacks a set of principles to justify him in not intervening. The criterion that guides the Rawlsian intervener is not the minimisation of pain, nor even the setting of unprogressive paces on the sure path of progress, but simply the prevention of egregious rights violations. Other things being equal, it's difficult to see why the detection of such violations should ever not need to military action, unless there were practical difficulties. The only excuse for inaction would be that war was likely to cause a net increase in violations. Mere inconvenience would not be an adequate excuse. Now, the modern public consciousness is largely Rawlsian. Large-scale rights violations that come to its attention result in demands for action that may, when feasible, be military. Quite often, of course, the modern public consciousness is right. The purpose of this paper is not to make a case for or against particular interventions. But comparison between our situation in the past does bring out a new bias towards aggression. All three of the models of war I've been discussing tend to encourage some appeal to the notion of civilization. As we've seen, the litigation model is a picture of war within a privileged circle. The self-preservation model encourages a view of war as an existential threat, as a response to an existential threat to civilized values. It pictures the opponent as one that stands outside that magic circle. And the civilizing model, by its nature, depends on a distinction between the civilized and those who ought to be coerced onto the path of virtue. There are obvious objections to the civilized/barbarous distinction, especially in a culture that's losing confidence that a broadly liberal order is the only political path that leads to economic modernization. It does, however, have the important virtue that civilization and barbarism are concepts that belong, in however crude a way, to social theory. They're focused at the level of whole societies. They thus encourage further and less simplified accounts of the nature of the societies in question that might expose the function of the rights violations we complain of, and therefore ask us to lead us to ask the question whether and in what sense they might form a necessary part of the least bad solution. The human rights-based model gives no such impetus. It simply notes bad things are happening, bad things, moreover, that there is a duty to stop. It would be quite untrue to say Rawls has no social theory, but it takes the form of simple and optimistic claims, such as the fact, which he spells with a capital F, that domination and striving for glory, the excitement of conquest and power over others, do not move democracies against other peoples. They have no point of contact with serious sociological inquiry. And here, surely, is the heart of our whole problem. The previous pictures of war I've been discussing were perfectly consistent with the most careful social thought of the periods that produced them. But Rawls can't find the things he says in a respectable modern social theory. So he has to be loyal to theories that were produced in previous generations. In essence, this means he was loyal to an old-fashioned view of irreversible convergent progress. Someone who acts upon such principles may well experience some initial successes, but will lack the intellectual equipment to work out politically feasible solutions in complicated alien cultural settings. He will have no defences against a panic-stricken oscillation between high-mindedness and ruthlessness, state-building and predator drones. It's not coincidental that this has been the history of Afghanistan and Iraq.
Thank you very much indeed.